This is Midday on WNYC. I'm Jonathan Capehart. Asthma is the most common childhood medical condition, with rates 50% higher in families below the poverty line who often live in rundown homes. In a recent investigation for Kaiser Health News titled, "Hospitals Find Asthma Hotspots More Profitable to Neglect Than Fix," Jay Hancock, a senior correspondent, and Rachel Bluth, a Peggy Gershom Webb reporting fellow, spent months reporting on asthma hotspots in the U.S. and researching hospital data in Baltimore, one of the worst asthma cities. Their reporting reveals that the medical system knows how to help, but it's reluctant to do so because there's no money in it. Their investigation appears on the Kaiser Health News website and in the Washington Post. Jay Hancock and Rachel Bluth, welcome to the show.
Hi, Jonathan. Nice to be here.
All right, Jay, and you just heard Jay. Jay, thank you for being here. We will have Rachel in a moment. Let me start with you, Jay. You opened your piece with the experience of Kayanta Parnell, a 9-year-old who suffered from asthma for most of his life. Where do Kayanta and his family live?
They live in Southwest Baltimore. It's a zip code that we zeroed in on when we tried to identify the worst asthma hotspot in the state of Maryland, zip code 21223, which we got to know very well. And Keontae is pretty typical of the neighborhood and other asthma hotspots, which is to say that he uses the healthcare system a lot. His mother is on a first name basis with the ambulance crews, whom she calls for asthma emergencies very often. And he's also a regular customer of the emergency room and sometimes the inpatient portion of local hospitals. Ironically, he is within blocks of one of the world's premier medical institutions, the University of Maryland Medical Center, that knows very well how to prevent these kinds of asthma attacks.
Let me bring in Rachel Bluth, who is now with us. Rachel, thank you for being here.
Thanks so much. Hi.
Let me sort of pull back out and ask a just basic health question, and that is, are children born with asthma, or does it develop as a result of environment?
So asthma, you're not born with asthma. It's definitely something that you develop, and there are a lot of environmental triggers that could contribute to a child developing asthma. Something that you'll see a lot, mouse droppings, cockroach dust, mold, dust mites, all of these things can trigger asthma in a child and help them develop it. And they're also things that you see in substandard housing.
Is it possible for asthma symptoms to completely go away with proper treatment?
It can definitely be managed. Somebody whose asthma is properly managed through controller medicine and good primary care should never need to go to the emergency room. Somebody with uncontrolled asthma, like Keontae had, might be visiting the emergency room several times a month, like he was.
You know, Jay, is this the fact that both you and Rachel mentioned that Keontae's mom is on a first-name basis with the ambulance crews, with the emergency room staff. Is the fact that they're using the emergency room because they don't have health insurance?
They have. They're covered by Medicaid.
Okay.
Which is lower income. Families in lower income neighborhoods often go to the emergency room as the medical provider of first resort because there's often no other alternative. And that's mm-hmm. true whether they have insurance or not. In Maryland, Maryland expanded Medicaid under Obamacare and had a pretty widespread Medicaid program before that. So the family has medical coverage and pretty good medical coverage, but as we've seen over and over again in the arguments about Obamacare, is just having insurance does not mean that you're going to have access to care. And one of the other problem we found with this community was, again, typical of low-income neighborhoods. Rachel mentioned the degraded housing and the triggers that were there. I mean, the street where the Parnell Somerville family lived was quite substandard. It was half the houses were vacant. There were piles of garbage in the street, visible rodents in the street. That's one challenge that people living there have. The other challenge that they have is very difficult access to primary care. What's primary care? That's your family doctor who you can see, who might tell you how to prevent these asthma attacks, who might talk to the family about using the medication properly, which became an issue for them, who can, you know, basically provide the kind of medical care that is seen as more or less routine in higher income neighborhoods. So they've got this. They've got two things coming at them. They've got how asthma triggers all around them, and a lack of community health workers and family doctors to tell them how to deal with that. What's the upshot? It's the emergency room, which is the most expensive, least efficient, and also the least effective way to treat this. But that's the pattern that they're in. And as we reported, it creates revenue for the hospitals, so they're sort of fine with it.
Right, and we will get into that in a moment. You mentioned asthma triggers, and one of them is rats, and you write about you report one mom in a neighborhood who wields a BB gun to keep rats away from her asthmatic child. Hey, Rachel, there is a neighborhood that has a very curious name. A neighborhood that's called the Forget About Neighborhood that your project focused on. Talk about that neighborhood. Why is it called that?
Yeah, so the residents there, it's a nickname that people who live there have sort of given it. They call it a forget about it neighborhood because they feel really left behind by some of the institutions and the power structures that should be helping them. They can't get somebody from the city to come pick up the garbage from the vacant lot. They can't get people to come clean up the vermin from the vacant houses. They can't get their landlord to fix some of the triggers that they've found in their homes. They really feel like the city and the healthcare industry there have really left them behind and aren't listening to their concerns and are making their children sick.
Mm-hmm. You know, let me stick with you, Rachel and Jay. Please jump in. What's interesting here is that, you know, we're talking about a neighborhood in Baltimore, and Baltimore is home to two of the country's most prestigious medical centers. You've got Johns Hopkins, and then you have the University of Maryland Medical Center. How is it possible that there are such poor health conditions and poor health outcomes in neighborhoods that sit in the shadow of these institutions?
Well, you've got to remember that asthma is a huge revenue maker for some of these places. You know, it costs around $871 per ER visit that the hospital takes on in revenue. And the hospitals know how to prevent this. There's been plenty of research done that there are really effective ways, low-cost interventions of preventing asthma by going into people's homes, by sending community health workers, by making repairs, you know, getting out the mold, getting out the mice and the vermin. And there is a program that Baltimore City has. I was there when they visited, Keontae's home, and it's really effective. They brought in a health worker who brought in dust covers for the pillows and copper sheeting to cover up mice holes, and provided the mother, Darlene, with some really good information about what was causing her son's asthma, how it works, how to better use her medication. And this is a really effective program. The city says that it reduces asthma by 89%, but they can only help 200 kids a year out of the thousands in the city that are impacted. So there's some really low-cost interventions that the hospitals aren't participating in that could really be helping people.
Jay?
Jonathan, I would add to that. I'd put in a small word for the hospitals, which is this isn't a business that they've historically been in, and it isn't something that's historically been expected of a hospital. It's a hospital, right? You go to the hospital when you're acutely sick, and they're very good at taking care of you all across America. And now people are suggesting that that's not enough, that given what's going on with health costs in America and how we're trying to change the system, that they shouldn't be just hospitals anymore, that they should be thinking about public health and community health. And that's a conversation that's going on in Washington and across the country, is how do we shift the money in this U.S. healthcare system that we have that is totally focused on making the cash register ring when somebody is sick. How do we take that? How do we take that money? We know there's billions of dollars in healthcare. There's, you know, it's not for a lack of investment or a lack of capital. How do we take that money and convert it to some of these projects, some of these initiatives, like we wrote about in our story, which is pay hospitals to keep people out of the hospital? That sounds really crazy, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there's a fairly decent consensus, and it's bipartisan in U.S. healthcare policy, that is what needs to happen, at least on a small basis. You know, let's take a stand, let's pick a population, and let's take the science that we know is working, and let's try to expand it and scale it. You know, so what does that mean for asthma? Let's find the highest utilization asthma patients in Baltimore. We know who they are. They're in a state database that we access to do this project. Let's identify them and deploy some modest resources, the ones the kind Rachel described. You know, get rid of the mice, do mite and mildew control, and see if it makes a difference for these patients that are costing the system tens of thousands of dollars a year. What was it, Rachel? We cut the data in a way that we saw the 50 highest utilizers. What did they end up costing the system?
In 3 years, 50 asthma patients netted $6.1 million for the hospitals. And, you know, we talk about hospitals needing to push care sort of outside of the emergency room. They're actually obligated to do that. They get these huge tax breaks that are for the express purposes of providing a community benefit. And often that looks like health fairs or, you know, educational programs, but it doesn't look like person-to-person interventions that could actually keep children out of the emergency room.
And, you know, and to that point, Rachel and Jay, well, what are the reasons given by executives at Hopkins and the University of Maryland Medical Center for not doing some of these, which to my mind, and I'm sure to a lot of listeners' minds, seem like common sense things?
They, first of all, they say, in essence, they say you're right. A very senior executive at Hopkins said, this is the right thing to do. We want to do it. So why aren't they? Well, the sort of squishy answer is they're huge institutions. The aircraft carrier analogy applies. And they haven't gotten to it yet. Historically, one focused reason why they didn't do it was, as we keep mentioning, the revenue. They made money off of it. They hospitals are in the business to do procedures, admit patients, fill the beds, and make money. What's interesting now in Maryland is that system has changed. Maryland has a really interesting, really innovative hospital regulatory system that hasn't really got enough coverage nationally, in which they regulate hospital prices like an electric utility. And they've done that for decades. Now they've gone even farther, and they've essentially guaranteed the hospital's revenue that they have. They say you won't be penalized for not admitting as many people. Take the revenue that you have and use it to go out in the community to decrease hospital admissions. It's a really, really counterintuitive and ambitious and in some ways radical design that Maryland has. It started in 2014. The results have been very, very lackluster, but the incentives are there. And the hospital's response is, well, we've always done it this way, and anyway, you need to, we don't want to invest our own money in these interventions. And we're talking about asthma here, but we could equally be discussing diabetes or congestive heart failure or other chronic conditions that, again, community intervention mm-hmm. can reduce hospital admissions. The hospitals say, okay, we'll make those investments, but you give us the money. You know, front us the money. Their multi-billion dollar budgets are not enough, they say, to go out and make those investments, which is sort of the lamest part of their argument.
Well, Jay, I'm sitting here wondering, are you surprised by the response of healthcare and hospital executives? I mean, a hospital is where people are supposed to go to get well. People look at hospitals as a place of healing, and yet they seem rather reticent about having their mission expand outside of the hospital walls.
They are indeed reticent, although if reticent means avoiding paying lip service to it, that wouldn't quite be accurate. They're very happy to pay lip service to it and to say, yes, this is, you know, we're innovating, this is where we need to go. But you just don't see it in action. But the thrust of your question is a really good one because it gets at the idea that this is really different. Hospitals are hospitals, and one of the commenters in the Post version of our story said, you know, this is nuts. This is like blaming fires that break out on the fire department, and you're suggesting that the fire department should go out and stop, you know, fix people's wiring and other things. And I thought that was a very effective question, a good way to frame it, although, in fact, fire departments do go out in the community.
Yeah.
They promote smoke detectors.
Right, they go around door to door in some communities, knocking on the door and saying, hey, have you changed the battery in your smoke detector?
Right. Right.
Yeah, Rachel.
It's important to remember that hospitals aren't only in the business of treating people when they're sick. They're also in the research business, and that definitely applies to Johns Hopkins. They've received, you know, $200 million in research grants to study how asthma could possibly be popping up in these places. But the fact is, we know how asthma starts. We know how to fix it. And if some of that money was diverted to actually treating it, we might have better outcomes.
And as you mentioned that Hopkins research, you talked with Patricia Brown, a senior VP at Hopkins, and I want to talk to you about what she told you when we come back from this break. I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm speaking with Jay Hancock, Kaiser Health News senior correspondent, and Rachel Bluth, a Peggy Gershom Webb reporting fellow, about their recent investigation for Kaiser Health News. Hospitals find asthma hotspots more profitable to neglect than fix. We'll be right back after a break. This is Midday on WNYC. I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I've been speaking with Jay Hancock and Rachel Bluth, Kaiser Health News, about their piece that's in the Washington Post and on the Kaiser Health News website. It is entitled, Hospitals Find Asthma Hotspots More Profitable to Neglect Than Fix. Jay and Rachel, thanks for being here. Before we went to a break, Rachel, you were talking about the fact that Johns Hopkins has received millions of dollars in research money to find out about asthma and things. And there's a woman by the name of Patricia Brown. She's a senior vice president at Hopkins in charge of managed care and population health. What did she tell you?
Jay can probably speak to this a little bit more than I can, but there's definitely an acknowledgement that there's a real imbalance between how money is spent on research and how money could be spent on medicine.
Jay.
Yeah, Hopkins, you said millions of dollars, Jonathan. Actually, Hopkins has received $200 million from the federal government in the last decade to do asthma-related research. And a lot of it has to do with exactly the sorts of community initiatives that we were talking about earlier in the piece. It study after study after study shows that it makes sense to identify asthma patients who are frequent users of the hospital and go there and show them ways not to use the hospital, to intervene, to do pest control, and all the things we've been talking about. And Hopkins keeps getting new grants to do the same research over and over again. And the researchers there are a little frustrated because they've done the research, they've shown the science, and it hasn't gotten folded into the community. And so I interviewed Patty Brown, who's one of their top people, and she acknowledges, and kudos to her for doing so right up, that this is the future. This is the way they want to go. Her quote was, "This is the right thing to do. We want to do it." And yet they haven't. And they've actually, to their credit, they've been exploring ways to try to make this happen in Maryland. It gets a little wonky, but one of the things that Hopkins wants to have happen and that housing activists in Baltimore want to have happen is to use Medicaid money. And we mentioned that Keontae and his family are on Medicaid. The idea is to take state and federal Medicaid money and use that to do some of the interventions that we've talked about. Mm-hmm. Use that to expand the home visitation program that Rachel reported on, that's so effective, to expand it, to do more than 200 families a year in Baltimore. Use that to do something like is going on at Children's National Hospital in Washington that we reported on, which is one of the few hospitals in the country that's doing anything like this. They, more than a decade ago, they started a program that did just what was, you know, totally a no-brainer for these cases, which is make sure that kids coming to the emergency room with asthma flares are referred to a primary care doctor practice and are referred to community health workers that can help them make these episodes occur less frequently. They did that. It was effective. They did a peer-reviewed, published study on it. That was research that was done probably in the early 2000s, and yet it's still not going on. So the idea is, in Maryland, is to take Medicaid money. We know it saves money. We know the Medicaid insurance companies would save money. They would have the incentives to go in and do these interventions, maybe set up a primary care clinic, maybe hire home health workers to go in, and they would reduce their hospital costs by reducing these admissions. But Hopkins and Patty Brown have been pushing that, mm-hmm. but it's still, for Hopkins, it's still somebody else's money.
You know,
they still want somebody else's capital to go in and do this, even though they're Johns Hopkins with, you know, amazing resources.
Well, there's something else that Patricia Brown told you when you interviewed her, Jay. She also told you, quote, "What we do is perhaps not sufficiently focused. And at the same time, quote, we have to have revenue. We're a business." And in reading that, I was just wondering, does this perspective reflect the larger problem of our healthcare system, where you have these hospitals, businesses, prioritizing profit over patient well-being?
Yes, I would say. In a word, the answer is yes. Hospitals have become very large businesses, and one of the first pushbacks you hear when you say, "Oh, you're too big, you're billions of dollars in revenue, what are you doing?" The hospitals will all tell you, and every hospital in Maryland will tell you this because they all fit this category. They'll all say, "Oh, we're nonprofit. We're not really a business. We're a nonprofit, so we don't really have a profit motive," which is just completely wrong. Hospitals, nonprofit hospitals, have just as much of a incentive to maximize revenue and maintain and increase their resources and their empires as any other organization does. These executives make multi-millions of dollars in salaries, the CEOs do, and they're, like any other organization, they're primarily concerned about maintaining their own footprint, taking care of their own employees, and not with helping the community, mm-hmm. and promoting health in the community that they're in the middle of, and that they receive huge subsidies for by the fact that they don't pay any taxes. They don't pay income tax on all the revenue and profits they book, and they don't pay real estate taxes. These are enormous subsidies. They have responsibilities to do more than what they're doing, more than just be a business, employ people, and collect revenue. And in fact, under the Affordable Care Act, their obligations are made more explicit and increased, even though they're still sort of squishy. Rachel mentioned community benefits that hospitals are obligated to do. There's always been an assumption that given all their tax subsidies, that hospitals need to give back and do something more for the community. Typically, they've done that by writing off a certain amount of their care. The Affordable Care Act said that's not enough. You need to, these obligations are real. This is the 21st century. Healthcare costs are really a burden on the country. You need to be more explicit about how you're helping the community. Right. You need to report to us on a regular basis. And that's sort of happening, but they're not really being held to account. But the idea is there that this needs to happen. Again, everybody says, great idea. Is it happening?
Right, is it happening? Rachel, earlier in the interview, you mentioned this data point about emergency room visits to treat Baltimore patients for asthma. According to the data, hospitals were paid $871 on average. You mentioned that before. Where I'm confused is it's probably because I haven't had any, you know, deep experience with the healthcare system. But you go on to write that for each inpatient case, the average revenue was $8,698. Can you explain to me, my simple mind, why the emergency room visit is $871 and the inpatient case is $8,698?
Yeah, it really speaks to what you guys were just talking about, which is that the incentives in the healthcare system right now are really skewed. Right now we operate under this, what they call fee-for-service system, where the more tests and treatments and, you know, procedures that are done, the more money a hospital makes because they get reimbursed for all of them. So the longer somebody is in the hospital, the more services they're going to get, the more the hospital is going to be reimbursed. And, you know, for a little less than half of that almost $9,000 bill, you could put air purifiers and, you know, mold abatement services in every house that needs it.
I mean, I think focusing on the fact that Johns Hopkins and the University of Maryland Medical Center are sitting right there in the middle of all of this, where they have all of this money, research money, as Jay was just explaining a moment ago, all of these subsidies in the way of tax breaks and things, the idea that they are surrounded by communities in need, not just financially, health care need, that they're not doing anything or being held to account or being pushed to do things, I think is pretty incredible. Why aren't they doing more? It's got to be more than the fact that they like the money. Is it that the government is not holding them accountable?
So
yes, go ahead, Rachel.
There's
Rachel.
Definitely an accountability problem. You know, this new model is new, and it's a little untested, and there isn't great reporting yet on how hospitals are using these tax breaks to help the community. And the scope of the problem is incredible. You know, we went up and down this street for months, and practically everybody that we talked to had asthma. You know, the three children in this family had asthma. All the neighbors had asthma. Every family that I talked to on the school playground had asthma. It's a really widespread issue.
Jay.
Yeah. Again, the model is new. The idea is new, and you know, this fits a much larger category, which is, I'm going to give you a wonky term that the policy people use, which is the socioeconomic determinants of health, which is a fancy way of saying that when you're poor, your health is not great, and when your health is not great, you're more likely to stay poor. It's a generational dynamic where you have people don't have access to. Let's go back to Darlene and Keontae and their family as an example. Very undependable income. They kept moving from house to house. The house where they lived in previously didn't have any asthma triggers. And Darlene had a job, and they moved to this new place full of asthma triggers. She stays home more now to take care of her family. That's less income. Family's sicker. And this sort of dynamic just plays out with multiple chronic diseases in multiple neighborhoods. And the hospitals have always acknowledged it's a problem, but at the same time, they've always said, you know, look, we're a hospital. These are societal problems that, you know, go down to education, that come down to, you know, let's be frank, the legacy of slavery that we're still seeing generations later. It comes down to the legacy of discrimination. Why is it a surprise that we have so many black families living in poverty when only a few decades ago it was impossible to take out a mortgage if you were African American?
Right.
Deep problems, and the hospitals have a hard time grappling with that.
In the little time that we have left, one industry we haven't talked about that I think figures prominently here is the pharmaceutical industry. What is their role in this, real quickly?
Well, the pharmaceutical industry is problematic for lots of reasons, as we've heard discussed during the presidential campaign in 2016, and since then, the pharmaceutical industry is actually in a position of, you know, not being a bad guy here. It's pharmaceutical, properly administered, these drugs can actually save costs. And I'm not aware of any super horror stories regarding price spikes in asthma medicines. The idea behind any drug is that you want to be on this drug so it'll prevent hospital visits and more expensive complications. And, you know, properly understood, asthma medications, you know, there's different kinds. There's crisis meds that you take when you have a flare. There's maintenance meds to keep a flare from happening. They really can be very effective, and in some cases even lifesavers. We haven't mentioned people die. Kids die from asthma. It's rare, but it happens.
Without proper maintenance, you have kids like Keontae who have to go to the emergency room and get these emergency treatments several times a month and be put on really powerful, damaging steroids for weeks at a time. That is totally preventable if anybody had educated his mother about how to use his controller medicine.
And with that, we're going to have to leave it there. Rachel Bluth, a Peggy Gershom Web Reporting Fellow, Jay Hancock, Kaiser Health News Senior Correspondent, thank you very much for being on the show. We've been talking about the recent investigation for Kaiser Health News. Hospitals find asthma hotspots more profitable to neglect than fix. Jay, Rachel, thanks again.
Thanks so much.